Back in 2018, Santiago Gomez and Alejandro Casas were just two young and hopeful founders fresh into YC. However, with a team of 25 working on an e-commerce business, they struggled to find funding. "There's no founder product fit," the investors would say. After a while, it clicked and their passion was elsewhere. They were challenged by a mentor to kill the startup and start building something, just the two of them, that really lit a fire under their feet. Oh yeah, and they should also be generating revenue in 6 months. Santiago reached out to his network and signed a 3-month contract with Rappi to map out problems within the company that they could solve through software. After an intense quarter, they came up with a platform to conciliate all the financial transactions ran through the super app, and an easy and reliable way for any company to manage their financial data. Symmetric was born, with Rappi's founders investing $2 million in its pre-seed round. The product naturally evolved and now has customers in over 35 countries. Santiago and Alejandro also got a lot more funding, including a $20 million Series A in 2022 and a $55 million Series B announced just a few days ago. In this chat, we talk about how Symmetric's culture contributed to its success, the tricky balance between technical excellence and rapid growth, and the challenges in fundraising that they didn't see coming. My name is Brian Reckworth, and this is Latitude Podcast. Vamos Latam. Hey, Santi, great to connect here. Congratulations are in order for closing your Series B. I kind of like to joke that the congratulations are very quick after you raise money because it means that you have a lot more work ahead of you. But I do think it's worth noting that it was a pretty substantial Series B round. And so I wanted to chat with you a little bit more about this. And, you know, before we got together, our team asked you a couple of questions. And in your answers, you'd mentioned that you were forced to learn that the only way is through. Can you describe that exact moment that you came to this realization?
It's funny. It's not that romantic as it sounds. I remember I saw that in a movie, and now I cannot remember which movie. Maybe it wasn't even like a really deep movie, but it resonated with me because I ended up saying it to our team a lot. The only way is through. And it started, you know, I started like thinking about what that meant. And in the end, what it means is that you gotta put the work in. You gotta, you know, do whatever you need to do. And it's hard to avoid sometimes, or easy to want to avoid some of the challenges that come with building, you know, in our case, a product for enterprises. It's easy to, you know, try to avoid or not enjoy the fact that, as part of a company that is based in venture capital, you have to do several pitches or talk and answer the same questions over and over again. But in the end, the only way is through. Like, you gotta do it. It's the only way, to get to where you want to go, but also to learn what you need in order to be able to get on to the next challenge. So yeah, I answered it because I started seeing our team come and say like, hey, what are we going to do with X and Y and Z? And I'm like, you know, nothing different than just trying to make it work, which is not something you probably want to hear, but that's the truth. I was just, you know, before I came here, I had a discussion for a new team and they were like, what are we going to do in between? You know, we're building a new team. So what are we doing in the meantime? And I said, You got to do everything. There's no other answer. So it's around those lines when I say the only way is through that I think about this.
It's kind of pushing through. And part of that process, I also hear you say, enjoy the struggle. And that is kind of a relative of what you just described. It's tangentially related to what you just described, because if the only way is through, you've got to embrace the struggle because it's going to suck sometimes. And so talk about how that's part of the culture you built, and maybe you can give me some examples of what that means in practice so we can learn from those.
So talking about Symmetric's culture has been something that we've done a lot, basically because we designed it in a way where I think it has created a lot of tools for our team, but also for other entrepreneurs that have learned from it. And learn the way we build it so that everyone can build their own. Of course, we are not, you know, the mega experts, but at least we think we've done like a really good job there. And it was all based on what Alejo, my co-founder, and I said in the beginning. And it was like, we need to make something that is not just like written on the wall, but can actually be like used. It can be a tool to scale in the future, whatever. And an example of that is our head of people and our head of sales. We hired them at the same time, and we were like 10 people. And people asked us, like, why do you need a head of people? You're 10 or less. And it was because we wanted to work on that. So it has evolved over time, as everything that we do. But something that we did really well, I think, is we divided and created 10 values for our execution values. So it's like 4 ways of working, and 6 are value principles, or like mindset principles. And what all of these 10 talk about is the way Alejo and I are, and the way Alejo and I would like to work. So it's really hard to like create a culture if you're not the one living by it, right? So we would like try to abstract what it actually meant for us to you know, work, what it meant for us to, what we liked, and the way we actually worked. And in doing that list came up enjoying the struggle. So it's one of the value principles, the mindset principles. And it talks a little bit about the path, right, of working and doing what you gotta do, because it will suck sometimes a lot. But, you know, everyone's doing their jobs, having, you know, the dream of accomplishing a lot. But it's not about only the success. Like, it's not about the moments like the Series B, for instance. It's about enjoying racing the Series B, which was not easy. And it came great, but of course it had a lot of work. It had a lot of ups and downs and yeses and nos. But that enjoying the struggle was part of, you know, the culture since we began. And I think it keeps on being till today. Being able to, you know, like not, quit when things get hard, when a client is mad, when something goes wrong in the product, when, you know, many things can happen when building a startup. So, for us, making sure that people are there enjoying that journey is really important. Not only it creates a team that is not only there for, you know, the Series B announcement, but is there for the Series B fundraising, which is hard, or is not there only because, you know, we're getting congratulations from our clients on how happy they are, but also they're in front of the client when it didn't go well. So yeah, it's part of this mindset that we have created of, you know, there will be moments where you will not normally enjoy it. It's not something like it's uncomfortable, but you've got to enjoy that as part of a bigger, you know, picture and process in the end.
And my last company, at one point, we wanted to articulate kind of these values, or as we call them, virtues. They're really a set of behaviors. We came up with an exercise, like when we were already kind of were operating. We said, if I'm going to build a company on Mars, who am I taking and why? And when you describe the why, like, I'm taking Andre because Andre is like this. It's a series of like behaviors, right? That's really what the kind of the cultural piece is. And double clicking on this specific enjoy the struggle one, I have to say, 10 seems like a lot. Hard to memorize. That's my initial reaction. Like, to, I struggle with this because I had 10 at one point, and then I was like, it's really hard for people to remember 10. So like, let's just try to boil it down into like less. But usually there's one or two that like prevail and become like the leading values that, you know, are surfaced a lot. And probably for you, enjoy the struggle is part of it. What have you most enjoyed as part of the struggle so far?
I have two. One, it's more like tangible. I think part of Symmetric's story is pivot. So, you know, we began with Propel, which was an e-commerce company. We did YC, and, you know, we closed it down. And that was a hard, really hard moment, you know, calling out of YC and so many expectations back in 2018, and changing that. And then, you know, I don't know how many, not a lot of people know about this, but we created the first version of what Symmetric became was a software that had a lot of like implementation needs. It needed a lot of technical teams to build it or to implement or make it useful. And in 2020, we were fundraising and we didn't fundraise, like it was a failure back then. And we said, like, what's going on? And we started seeing like scalability was an issue. And then we said, like, let's build it again, but in a no code, with a no code approach, which is what we do today. So our clients, which is our users, so we empower FinOps teams and accounting teams to automate their controls, right? So we needed them to be able to build these automations and integrations. And we began and said, we need a product team. And we were a technical team, but we were not a product team. Like, we didn't know what it meant to build product. And I remember that as one big challenge where we had a lot of good technical people. We had a lot of ideas, but we had no idea on what to, you know, create. And then we sold to enterprises. We sold to bigger clients. So there was this whole phase of building the first version of the product that was not easy to do. It took almost a year until we got our first client with that version of the product. Today, 100% of our clients are in that technology. But it took a while to make it work, to make sure that it had what it needed at an enterprise level to work. So I remember that one as one. It was really interesting. And it's related to the second one. The second one is probably a more constant one. And I know, as you say, 10 may seem a lot, but we have so many that go together well. So another one is we seek perpetual evolution. And it talks a little bit about, yeah, evolution and being better day by day. And when you take enjoying the struggle and perpetual evolution, what you're saying is you got to enjoy the fact that you need to make yourself better. So I always tell our team, like, I work every day on myself to make sure I'm good enough for them, because I know they're working for on themselves. So if I don't do it, like, they will leave me behind in a way. So that's probably the biggest one, like my the one I enjoy the most. And it's not the easiest because sometimes it takes a lot of humility and like down to earth and like feedback or hard feedback, about getting better, you know, or being better, being a better leader, being better at technical stuff, or being better at, you know, so many levels that you got to in order to scale a company. So probably that one, I'd say, is my favorite mixed with the hardest.
What is the single most effective or important thing you've done to kind of level up yourself as you, you know, because it's hard as a CEO, as a founder, especially if it's like the first time you're leading a venture-backed company at scale and it's growing. What is the one thing that you've been able to do that's really forced yourself to like step up and get uncomfortable, but stretch yourself?
In the end, it's about not thinking that you are like the last version of yourself and accepting that. I think like being a founder and an entrepreneur, usually you'll have a lot of people cheering you on and saying, hey, you're great. And usually it's like, we are people that are, maybe we're not coming from like these super experienced jobs and trying to build stuff, which is really important. So in the end, like accepting the fact that you are not an experienced CEO, you are not an experienced CEO. Sometimes some are, but the vast majority of us, we aren't. And making sure that we have that in the middle of our like conscience, because we don't know it all. Because for many of us entrepreneurs, it's the first time that we're leading companies the size of our companies, right? So like taking that into account, and I always say being an entrepreneur is a mix of like a lot of determination and thinking you can do it, but a lot of humility and like being down to earth to the fact that you are not an expert. But you know, you have what it takes. It's just that you've never done it before, right? So accepting that, I think, is really key. And I always say this to other like fellow founders, and it's like, you've got to get the help. You know, you cannot build a big company by yourself. And it's not the help on telling the team like, hey, you can help out here. It's help at many levels, right? It's help at a peer level to with other founders. It's getting help from advisors and board members and investors and like getting all of that, of course, filtering out because you get a lot of feedback and not all of it is completely useful, but still like being, you know, really determined with your ideas, but also down to earth in the fact that you've got to, you know, step it up and constantly get the help to build the next phase. We're not experts in everything that we do. And you know, especially being a founder where you are in front of all of the company, right? And you can bring the expert and hire the expert CTO, expert CRO or whatever. But in the end, they're just like experienced people, but they don't know about your business, right? So mixing both sides of things, you know, outside experience, but what you've learned by yourself and making sure you're humble enough to put that in the mix. I think that's really important.
You mentioned getting help even from other founders. And you know, I understand that, and maybe you could tell us about how Symmetrek came about from YC to getting Rappi as your first customer, how you pivoted and evolved to arrive at where the software is today.
Yeah. So coming out of YC, we started, you know, having a lot of questions around was that what we wanted to build. I think Rappi was really opportunistic on the fact that we were selling, you know, like e-commerce is a way to get traction because the value that you are creating, you start with something that you're selling. Someone else already built it, you know, already built the value of whatever you're selling. In our case, it was clothes, right? So it was, no, I'm not going to say easy, but it was a quick way to get traction. We had a lot of, you know, like things down the road, a lot of learnings and a bunch of things, but coming out of it, out of YC, we asked ourselves, like, if we could start over, like, would we be doing this? And it was a mix of things. It was not just one question, but also like, we didn't like inventories or having warehouses. It was not part of like what we liked. We liked technology and we liked companies and we were like doing a business that didn't look like something that we would do. Also, investors were giving a lot of feedback and saying it was the first time I heard this, but they were saying that there was no founder product fit, which was like, they always said, we love you guys. We think you're an amazing team, but we don't see why you're doing this. So we talked to YC. They were like, just shut it down. Don't do it. This has been working for so, like, such a short time. Like, don't stay thinking about everything that you lose because you're not losing anything. What you gotta do is, you know, get up and running. And if you want to keep on being an entrepreneur and creating a company, you, let's say you have 6 months. In 6 months, you have to have revenue and something that you're building and it's really exciting. In the end, this like story has a happy ending only if that happens. So we shut it down. We had to let go like 80% of our team. It was a small team. We were like 25. We ended up, you know, just being 5. And we began, you know, like writing on a whiteboard and understanding like that on that framework and that same question, like, what would we do if we had another opportunity? And, you know, we started thinking about many of the problems that we had and we came up with this idea that was more like a treasury platform. I was saying like, hey, I hate the fact that in Colombia, you kind of pay $5 without talking to your accountant because you need to, you know, do the withholdings and it's a withholding. If you're in one city, it's a different one. If you're in another and these other things. So we started working around those lines. And we built this MVP that we called We Expenses. We had like, I think 3 months down the road, we had like 15 clients that didn't use the platform. But you know, in Endeavor, actually in that same Madrid ISP, Simon and Sebastian from Rappi got selected as Endeavor entrepreneurs as well. And I worked with them, you know, from the Endeavor side since then. And Simone had been, you know, in contact with us throughout being our YC founder and everything. And we told him like, hey, we just killed Tropeo. We're building something new. He was like, come in. And I remember he was the first person that did not ask about like what's going to happen with the clothes, like what are you going to do with the technology. We were used to explaining ourselves, and he was like the first person that said, why are we talking about this? I don't care about Tropeo. What are you doing today? And we told him about this, and he said like, you know, I have a proposal, and it's, why don't you try to come here? We have a lot of challenges in the finance team. You have 3 months. I'll pay you, you know, like what you need to keep your team right now. And let's see in 3 months if you're able to solve some of the challenges. What's really funny is that is the same thing we do today. And it is empower finance teams with tools that they can use by themselves. Because in that moment, Rappi's finance team needed technology, but they didn't have it. Yeah. And we were that technology. But then the product didn't exist. We were just like the tech team for the finance team. Actually, if you see in many enterprises, the other tech team that exists, apart from the tech team that builds product, does BI and everything, is the FinOps team. So that's where we began, and that keeps being true today. And we started working with them. It was really hard in the beginning. 3 months after, we had not done anything. We didn't understand the problem. I remember people at Rappi, which are really good friends today, were like, we don't believe you anymore. You know, don't waste our time anymore. But magically, in January of 2019, we launched our small version of what started to become Symmetric, and it started working. And we provided visibility and order in transactional visibility, understanding what was going on with the transaction. And it flipped, and we started becoming this source of truth, of financial truth. And well, Rappi's our oldest client today. So that's how Symmetric began.
I want to dig into this because it's really interesting. If for those founders listening right now that are looking to solve problems for in a B2B context, were you just like literally sitting in their office and like studying what they were doing in finance? Did they pay you? Did you just like go there and be like, hey, I'm like working for free to understand? Tell me more about how you uncover that, because that's super fascinating to me. And I think that a lot of founders don't know where to start, but there's so many problems to be solved in these companies that the closer you get to the problem, the more revelations you have about what could be scaled in other companies.
How that worked is that Simon was really nice, and he said that he would pay for, I think it was 4 months. But then after the second month, the CFO said like, this doesn't make any sense. We're not going to pay you. So we did not get paid for, I think, 2 more months. And then when it started working, they started paying again. So we actually moved into Rappi. So we literally like locked our office that was full of clothes. And we moved into Rappi. We took a whiteboard that we had, and we just moved into our offices. And we started talking to them and understanding like the actual problem. And why didn't they need tech? Like, what was going on? So in that moment, like, we did a lot of stuff that we don't do today. But in the end, when trying to figure out and building an enterprise like product, you cannot like pretend or want your ideas to be the reality of like a specific enterprise or big company, especially if we're talking about like specific finance problems or things that are done differently in every country. I know there are some entrepreneurs that, you know, went through these companies and come out and build their own platforms like out of their experience, which is great. So they have a huge head start. But the truth is, like, those first years building this unscalable product that we have, were key into like understanding what was it that we were trying to solve with our no-code approach, which is our technology today. Because that liberty, although many will say it like, oh, that's not scalable, you know, it's almost like working, doing like development, specific developments for clients, that's what really made it clear to us what the actual product needed to have. So when in this moment that we talked before where we said, hey, let's do the no-code, let's do an approach where our users are the ones doing the automations, we had a roadmap, an initial roadmap of things that we knew that would work for many of our clients. It was, of course, a technical challenge, but at least in terms of like the actual what we wanted to build, it was way more clear. Yeah. So yes, we moved there. We were there for, I think, 7 months. In month five, we got our second and third client. But then, like, of course, it became like unbearable because our team was growing. We were inside their offices, so we moved out. But today, you know, we're still really close to them and they're part of, you know, what the product that we built. They're part of our story. And like, it's amazing how you get to see entrepreneurs that, you know, pay it forward and talking about Endeavor, right? Also multiplying their effect and like pushing their impact through these kind of stories, where it was like Rappi's problem, but it became Symmetric's product.
Simon is a very generous guy, and the impact that him and Sebastian have had on the ecosystem in Latin America is like, it is tremendous, right? They're just forces of nature, and they're very kind in their willingness. I mean, I remember having multiple conversations with both of them. They deeply care. They have reached back and pulled so many people up, and it's something that I think is absolutely kind of fundamental. Endeavor has the same ethos. And anyways, it's great to see stories like yours where you were able to get your first, you know, start there and customer learn, you know, and I'm sure that it helped a lot having them as an initial customer. I'd love to kind of double click on a few things, because your product that you're building, one of the most critical things about it is there's not a lot of margin for error, right? Given that you were talking about finance, accounting, how do you balance this kind of technical precision and excellence while you're building something with outside expectations and you're trying to move quickly and build a product that can scale? So what's your take in terms of how to manage that in an efficient way?
I wish I would tell you that we have it solved, but we don't. But we have implemented a lot of things that have helped a lot. When building, you know, this type of complex softwares, in the end, it's all about quality, right? Like quality control and making sure that it works and that it's producing the actual data that it's supposed to produce. First, we have a team, and this is something that we've done differently, and it is our product team is not built with product people. Which I love, and we have some of them, but the leadership is probably people that were absolutely unrelated to product and technical products. We have brought people that were accountants, operational, you know, FinOps people, that used to do audits. Some even were our clients before. And this is a complete change in the way that we usually see product teams being built. And the big change there was that, you know, we're pulling product by people that were the owners of the problem and that are our users, right? So this has changed, and this has given us like a compass of understanding what is really, really important, what we need to guarantee, where we can, you know, have a little bit more slack, and what we need to build. And then the tech team, so we worked, as I told you, in this other version that was really technical. So the tech team that built the product, the first versions of the product, used to be the ones doing all of these configurations in the other system. So having a technical team that is not far from the client was key as well. They knew our users, they knew their problems, And that completely changed the way that we were developing, because we were not like doing this kind of blind. We really understood what needed to happen. Of course, sometimes I'd like to go a little bit faster, but I know in the end that our clients will, you know, prefer things to go a bit slower, but the quality to keep being up there, right? We cannot sacrifice quality in such a complex product that does and touches public companies' finances and balance sheets and PMLs and everything. So I think it's a mix of things, but I'd say that the main thing there was having like the product being built by people that knew what was important from the user standpoint.
I want to ask another couple quick questions before we wrap up. First of all, you were able to really accelerate growth from your Series A to your Series B round. You 4X'd your growth in, you know, around 2 years. So you had a pretty strong kind of, you know, strong growth there. What would you say is the number one kind of factor that was able for you to unlock growth going from the Series A to the Series B?
So I think it's like when I was working at Endeavor, we always said that startups only need to operate and grow and sell. When I think about back into what we have today, even as a Series B company, you know, in a growth stage, we still operate and scale and grow. So the two things that happened were we really got it organizing the distribution team. We implemented several frameworks that completely changed the way our distribution team was working. And also we made the product team a little bit bigger. And we were really, really like into understanding what was happening. So I don't want to get really technical here because I could stay the whole day thinking and explaining the FinOps process. But when you have a product that is ingesting all of the transactional data from a big company, so we ingest around 200 million records per day from 35 countries around the world, and you organize that and you give visibility to these clients, you have a lot of opportunity to work with that information. And we launched this building block that we created, which is called the Accounting Translator. And that gave us a huge like value proposition increase. So when you build product, you usually have, you know, or at least we divide it into three things. It's either you're deepening your product market fit, so making sure that you're locked into that. You're widening your product market fit, so going into other areas, or you're doing like market requirements. So for the first couple of years, we were only doing market requirements. So like working with enterprises, what were the things that were required by our markets for our product to work and be accepted as a like useful tool? But then we got to product market fit expansion. And when we launched this accounting translator that keeps the integrity between the transactional data and the ERP and the financial statements so that you have visibility from, you know, the balance sheet or the P&L back to one specific transaction, that changed the game. And that has been, you know, one of our biggest bets today.
One last question before we wrap up. You know, I'd love to get your sense of what's the biggest difference between raising building capital and growth capital. Maybe share a little bit more about the challenges that you face in your fundraising journey that maybe you didn't see coming.
Yeah, I really like a framework that one of our investors uses. And it's like, as you go down the line of raising, you know, C to A to B to C or whatever, it seems like you're going down the P&L. Like a seed, you know, or Series A, you're working on top line P&L, like generating revenue growth, everything. And then you start going down through it, you know, like gross margin, operational and everything. So it seems like the Series B is in between, you know, that gross margin and still, of course, it doesn't mean that you're not worried about the top line. It means that you start worrying on like things lower down the line. The big difference, I think, was that we had to show a really like solid business model, especially at the time we are today. We didn't know how much time it would take to get, you know, the due diligence done or these kind of things. that the round did not take that much. I don't mean timing, like we were racing for a lot of time. Fortunately, our round, we opened up data room in November 15, and in the 15th of December, we signed the term sheet. So it was just 1 month, really intense. We're not fully prepared for what came with due diligence, and we were able to make it work. But I think you got to have the structure. You got to have, you know, the numbers. You got to have visibility. You got to have so many other things that you're usually not worried in the beginning. So I think that was a big difference there in the actual like process of doing the fundraising. In strategy wise, I think showing a global opportunity was key for us. Growth capital is thinking about really big markets. And that's something that I always say and tell to our entrepreneurs, we need to think bigger in terms of market. LATAM is huge, yes. But if you have the opportunity and you're working in tech, of course, not everything is easy to go global. But in our case, where we're doing pure tech, we were going after a global market, right? So I think that was key. Investors there are looking for opportunities that can really become huge. That doesn't mean that there are some companies that staying in one or two countries is big enough, but it has to be big enough, right? The market has to be billions and billions of dollars. And being able to prove that is really important. And I think that was the key thing here. And it was like, show us that what you're doing can become huge and will, and of course, the other, you know, that the company works and everything, but show us that this can really get big. I think that was key in this growth like round.
No, that makes tons of sense. And, you've been on the journey now for several years. And so I like the analogy of how, as you, you know, you raise capital in each round, it kind of goes a little bit deeper down the financial stack to not just top line. Now we're looking at, you know, we're looking at the gross margin. We're looking at kind of the profitability. And I think that that's, it's a simple way of explaining kind of how, you know, people like growth investors look at things. I want to thank you for making the time to come on. And, you know, it's exciting to see, you know, Colombian companies building with this, you know, global mindset. And really going after, you know, big opportunities. And so it's, we'll look forward to chatting again and finding out, you know, how things are going. But I'm really bullish on what you're building, and it's going to be exciting to follow your story.
Yeah. No, thank you so much for having me. And, you know, we are huge fans of what you guys do. So I think we can keep on, you know, making sure LATAM is present around the world.
Absolutely. Man.
That's something that I always tell our team. And it's like we're building tech, but it's being used worldwide. And it's not because it's cheaper, it's because it's the best.
Thank you for listening to Latitude Podcast. Subscribe wherever you listen to your podcast for more talks with great founders and investors. I'm your host, Brian Reckworth, Vamos LATAM.